So you're listening to Life Downstream, and we are sitting here today with Mac Burns. He is the executive director for the Clatsop County Historical Society. He has been living here in Astoria for the last 17 years. Mac, thanks so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thanks for letting me come in.
So before we kind of dive into some topics here related to history and different kind of roles you've played throughout your life, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? I know you're...
Sure. Well, the first Burns family came over from the... Sure. I'm the executive director of the Clatsop County Historical Society. Been here for 17 years. So we operate four different museums now.
Okay.
The Captain George Flavelle House, the Heritage Museum, and the Old City Hall, the Uppertown Firefighters Museum, and then just about 9 years ago, we opened the Oregon Film Museum in the Old County Jail.
Nice.
Been working in museums, in the museum field now for 25 years, and never really thought that that would be my career. It was just sort of something I enjoyed. History was fun, but I didn't learn until way late into my life that it could be a career.
So I'm glad you brought this up because, you know, I think people out there might be listening thinking, okay, I have an interest in history. It's a fascinating topic, but what can I do with my knowledge of history? You know, how do people make a living as a historian? Could you talk a little bit about what you've learned, you know, throughout decades of studying history? What are options for people if they're interested in history?
Sure. Oh, there's tons of stuff. And I like kind of telling my getting into the field, because I was actually in college, I was a double major, I was political science, and that was going to be my career. And I was just taking so many history classes. The history professors were like, if you just take two more, you'd have a major. And I said, okay, sure, I'll double major. But I never thought about it as a career. You know, and even those professors at college would just talk about a degree in history is good for going on to get a law degree, or it's a good firm basis for critical thinking in the future. But they never talked about here's a job you could go get. So political science was the job. And that didn't really work out the way I'd hoped. And I did a job that I didn't really enjoy out of college for a couple of years. And when that became kind of untenable to me, I'd put enough money in the bank that I could just quit as a kid. And I don't want to say I spent time finding myself, but I spent time exploring different potential options for what I might do. And as that money started to run down, I just on a kind of a whim, enrolled at graduate studies to work on a master's degree at the University of New Mexico. And it was really a very personal history interest that I had. I've always been a Billy the Kid nut, Old West nut.
What's the source of that interest in Billy the Kid? Is there something, some aspect,
you know,
of his character?
Growing up, I loved all the Westerns, Bonanza, even though I'm too young for Bonanza. I saw it on reruns, The Lone Ranger. I just always loved cowboys and Indians and Western. I read every Louis L'Amour book I could find. And then when I just was getting into college, my parents relocated. I grew up in upstate New York, and they relocated to New Mexico. And somewhere on one of those first trips down there, discovered that this whole Billy the Kid thing was pretty for real. There's a huge, just like we picture. I mean, there was gun battles and there was this range war. And it was fascinating to me. And as I read more and more about that, there was a specific guy that rode with Billy that I just became fascinated on, because there's been a million and 10 books written about Billy the Kid and the Lincoln County War, but very little had been written about this one specific guy. So I go to the University of New Mexico thinking just vaguely that maybe I could write a book about this guy. Maybe that's part of earning
a master's degree thesis,
or maybe somebody will pay me to go do the research I need to do, or maybe there's a grant. I mean, I knew nothing about fundraising, and I was doing okay in the classes, but everything there, the teachers were always talking about, you're going to go on and get a PhD and you'll be a college professor. And I had student loans for my bachelor's degree, and I was not sure how I was going to continue to pay for a master's degree at a semester or so paid for. And I went into one professor one day and just started chatting with him about, why do we even have a master's degree and what can I do with this degree then? And out of nowhere, he says, well, sounds like you want a degree in public history. And the clouds parted and a chorus, you know, sparing up and the sunlight came on me. I said, what's that? And he described it as, it's applied history, it's museum studies, it's public history out in the public, not in the ivory tower of the college classroom.
So archivists.
And I said, where do you go for that? And I ended up going to, I applied to two different places he recommended, ended up in Wichita State University. And my first semester there, it was kind of an introductory class. And even though I'm 23, 24 years old, every week I'm deciding this is going to be my career. The first week we had a local museum director come in. I said, I want to run a local museum. Next week we had the archivist for Wells Fargo came out from San Francisco. I said, oh my gosh, I want to be a corporate archivist. And I love Coca-Cola. Maybe I'll go. Oh, I can't say that in this town, but maybe I'll go run the Coca-Cola Museum. And then the next week a park ranger came in and, oh, I want to work at a national park somewhere. And there were all these different jobs that I had never thought about. I'd never been exposed to. And I'm a kid whose family vacations always included some kind of a museum or history thing. And I'd always been interested in history. My imagination always ran wild. And nobody had ever taken the time to say, hey, you can get paid to do something you really enjoy.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, if people out there listening and who are interested in history know about all these different options. You know, I before the show we were chatting and you had talked a little bit about how when people hear the term history, a lot of times people think dates and details and all these specifics. And it sounded like you were kind of a little bit worried that, you know, people's obsession with dates or, you know, having to learn dates and all these little details, it might drive people away from kind of some of these bigger ideas.
I think definitely. I think that I'm not going to say everybody loves history. I think there are a lot of people that like it, but don't fully embrace it because they were taught in eighth grade or seventh grade to memorize a whole bunch of dates. And those dates really don't matter. It's the concepts and maybe that this happened before this and that this had to happen so that the next thing could happen. That's the important thing, not the specific dates. And you know, some people are just never going to enjoy it. They're into something else. And that's great. I mean, my father's a scientist and I am not into science. But a lot of people like stories, and that's what history is. They're stories. And, you know, we all probably watch TV or movies, or we like listening to our friends tell stories, funny stories about what happened to them. That's history. That's hearing a good story. And that's really the gist of what I get out of history and what I enjoy about what I do. You know, I applaud teachers that can sit in a classroom that maybe only five of those 20 kids want to be there. My audiences, for the most part, want to be there. So they're already halfway to meeting me that they want to hear a good story from me.
They're museum visitors who have sought out that information, right?
And they don't want to be disappointed. They don't want to be bored. You know, they want to be entertained. And I like to say that it's a combination of entertainment and education. It's edutainment. And while I say that tongue in cheek, I'm also very serious about it.
I know, you know, anybody who is really interested in history and throughout their lives, continually reading, continually learning, you know, there's this kind of effect that can happen over time where the more you learn, the more you kind of expand your horizons, there's this paradoxical feeling like, wait, I know less than I thought I knew, you know, how do you wrap your head around that?
There's a great philosopher that I really believe a lot of what he says is true. Barney Rubble, that says it takes a smart man to know he's stupid. And I firmly believe that. You know, as a kid, maybe your friends aren't as into history as you are, and you learn something. So as you're chatting, you're the smartest one there because you know this story. And maybe they don't know what really led to the American Revolution or why Ethan Allen is really important to the American Revolution. And you can lord it over them and tell them that story. But then you go to college and there's some college professor there or some other kid that knows 20 times what you know. And you realize, wow, I didn't really know as much as I did. And then you get some of their knowledge and hear their stories and you think, okay, now I know it. And then there's always somebody that knows more down the road.
And you're at peace with this idea that this endless process, right? I think some people might, you know, see that as daunting or feel... I don't know. I guess, you know, if somebody kind of lets a little too much ego get in this process, they might feel like, oh, I'm not as good at this, you know, interest as I thought I was. it sounds like you're saying, like, this kind of stokes your curiosity, you know? Like,
oh, definitely.
The more you... Because
why didn't I know that?
Yeah.
And it's kind of stunning. I mean, I'll watch a Ken Burns special, or I'll read a new book or hear a lecture, and I'll be stunned. Why didn't I ever hear that story before? Why didn't I know more about that?
Hmm.
And they can be some big things. I remember just a few years ago, learning more about the assassination of Lincoln, and that it was, I always knew there was a group of people and it was going to be a complete decapitation of the American government, but I'd never heard the specifics of the guy going in and stabbing the Secretary of State and Secretary of War, rather, and the guy was supposed to kill the vice president, but he chickened out and didn't shoot and walked away. And why didn't I learn that in high school? Why didn't I learn that in any of the books I'd read up to this point?
Do you ever have kind of moments like that that then force you to kind of go and find another book? And
Dig deeper. Yeah, because then I hear that and I'm like, okay, I need to read a book about this. I need more details on that subject.
I know, you know, in terms of what areas of history you're specifically interested in. I know you're really interested in westward expansion. Mm-hmm. You're also interested in, you know, this time period that existed between World War I and World War II in the U.S. I'm curious, what is it about that era that's so kind of fascinating for you?
Well, I'm going to get on a patriotic soapbox here, and I always do when I describe this time period. What fascinates me is, you know, in our modern world today, we think the recession we just went through was really bad. Mm. And I'm not going to make any judgments on that. But during the Great Depression, 25% of people in America are out of work. And there's no welfare. There is nobody to help. And if you've ever read Grapes of Wrath, that's dead on. That is real. And you can watch your family starve and there's nobody that's going to help you. There's no government agency that's just going to give you something. And, you know, you often wonder, what would I do if my kids were starving? What lines would I cross? And there's republics and democracies all over the nation, all over the world that are turning to a Hitler, to a Mussolini, to socialism, to communism. And that never happens here. The most that we ever vote for that radical fringe is like 12%. We've continued to vote Republican or Democrat. Hmm. And there's just, to me, this amazing sense of belief in America that somehow this is going to turn out okay, that I don't have to turn radical, that I don't have to overthrow this government and start over. And it, to me, it's a testament to the amazingness of the U.S. Constitution. Hmm. There's a guy named Frederick Jackson Turner, a very famous historian that talked about the frontier thesis that we had this vast continent and rabble rousers or troublemakers would go west and they wouldn't overthrow the local government in New York or Connecticut. They would just head west and start over someplace where they could make their own lives the way they thought they should, or make their own town governments the way they thought they could. And, after we went across the entire continent, we had Alaska still that we could send our people up to. And maybe that's the reason this country didn't go down another path. But that just fascinates me because I just can't picture on a personal level, what would I do? We are very fortunate to have been born in this nation in this time period. And maybe 100 years from now, it'll be even better. But all of human history, I mean, our lifespans, the medical science, our ability to get in a car and drive across the country, or get in an airplane and be there in 2 hours, 3 hours. It's a crazy future world.
Yeah.
From 100 years ago, from 200 years ago.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if somebody is interested in history and they can anchor all this progress in a historical context, you appreciate it that much more, right?
Sure.
You know, you look around at what we have today, and if you know where we've come from and mm-hmm. all of these different things that people have had to kind of work through to get this, you know, it makes you kind of see it in a new light. Right?
I had a college professor once that the classroom that we were in had no exterior windows. There was a door with a little window in it and that was it. And at least once or twice a semester, he'd walk over and kind of cover the window and he'd just turn the light off. So it was pretty darn dark. And then he'd turn the light on, he'd turn it off, he'd turn it on, and he would just look up at the ceiling, the fluorescent lights, and he'd get the most amazing smile on his face, and he'd say, "It's amazing. Just think what somebody 200 years ago would think about this." And he'd turn them on off about two more times. And just to look at the things that we have in our lives in that context, I think makes you appreciate a little bit more.
Yeah. I'm curious, what if to a person who's interested in actually doing public history like you were talking about, what would you say to that person? Because I have somebody who's just talking about becoming an archivist.
I think there are more undergraduate programs now than there were 20 years ago, and certainly more than 40 years ago. But just on a standpoint of, I hate to spend a whole bunch of money going to college to discover what I want to do. Mm-hmm. If as a younger person, we take volunteers, there's events, there's activities. You can hang out in our museums and kind of learn about what we do, or go hang out at Fort Clatsop and the Rangers will, I mean, they're going to be able to spend 40 hours a week with you, but they'll spend some time with you. I think any of us in this realm, we're not in it for the money, because we could all be making more money as lawyers or something else. Yeah. We do it because we're passionate about it. And part of being passionate about it is sharing what mm-hmm. steps you should take or what you can do.
Yeah.
So we got a lot of museums and a lot of historical things in this region. I would tell them to go check them out and make that call. And I will talk about public history anytime, any place, to anybody. Because I wish somebody had done it to me earlier.
Mm-hmm. Mac, I love hearing you suggest that students or you know, even somebody who's looking for a career change, an adult who wants to kind of get into something new, that you recommend that they go and kind of hit the pavement and introduce themselves to someone at one of these museums or one of these places. I think mm-hmm. sometimes people are nervous if they don't see the job listing, you know, posted on Craigslist or wherever. Yeah. Well, that means it doesn't exist, and they, my only option yeah. is this. And I, you know, I like this idea of, hey, just take some initiative with what you're interested in and go and introduce yourself to somebody and just say, hey, I kind of want to learn more about this. I don't know, is there any way that I could kind of intern and come in once a week? Or I love that idea.
And that's one of the key things, too. I mean, there is a lot in the museum world that is tedious. It's one of the reasons I am not a curator. And I applaud those that are organized enough. I am not organized enough. And we'll get a volunteer that'll come in a lot, and I'll work with them, and I'll take them on the behind-the-scenes tour and show them the Tower of the Flavel House where the public can't go, and I'll get them excited by our mission and what we do. And then we'll, without really knowing what their specific interest is, because they'll say, I don't know, I'm just kind of curious and I want to help. Mm-hmm. And we'll have them doing a project and they'll get bored by it and they won't come back and tell us. They'll just kind of stop coming in. I mean, my first museum job, I had a year-long internship at a place called Old Cowtown Museum, which focused on the 1860s and 70s. And they assigned me to the curator. And my first day in a museum setting, professionally, I spent with tweezers and a magnifying glass pulling dead bug carcasses off an 1860s rug. And if that was going to be my career, I would never do it. I know how to do it. I'm glad I know how to do it.
Wait, do you look back on that and think there's some element of, you know, whoever assigned you to do that task, the curator, they were really just trying to make you kind of cut your teeth on something, you know, grueling and hard.
I think looking back that there was a little bit of, it's going to be funny to make him do this all day. I think there was a little bit of, this is the project that I'm working on right now, so I'll just have Mac work on it because it had to be done. But I think there's probably a little bit of fun at the same time as if he comes back to this, then I'll know he's serious.
Yeah.
And I know I'm not wasting my time at that point.
Yeah. I think that's one of the biggest things that kids have trouble with, is just making a phone call.
Yes.
Like it's crazy. I'll tell people I have four people you could talk to in this profession that you might be interested in talking to. And then they never make the call, and then they'd miss out on things that they could have done, or at least, you know, some sort of job opportunity that they could have had in probably a week's time. They forego it because they're afraid about making one phone call.
Yeah, and if anybody had ever talked to me about this as a career, I could have saved a year of the wrong college and the wrong major, a year of community college getting my GPA back up, and then I could have focused in college instead of the political science, and I could have saved about 4 years before I stumbled into this.
Yeah. Wow.
And I would also add to that, don't give up if that first phone call you get the wrong museum person that says, I don't have time for this. Mm-hmm. There are those of us out there, and there are some that it's now a tedious job to them, and I got to go talk to a kid and show them what I do. That won't make the time, but I think more of us would than wouldn't.
Mm. Yeah, and then there are the people out there who aren't even necessarily involved in that profession, but are still making some, you know, big and have some big interest, and they keep doing it, like a John Gutenberger or somebody else out there.
Oh yeah, I mean, there's tons of people, and I meet them all the time. It's kind of funny because I'll meet somebody who gets down on this kind of whole conversation about, well, how'd you get into this career. And, you know, they're selling insurance, or they're some kind of insurance adjuster, and they're probably making three times as much as I do. But you could just see that there's this wish that, oh, you have the best job. I wish I could do what you do. Well, the first museum that I ran, I went around my first few weeks and I met each of the board members, and there was this bank vice president I went to meet. And we go into his office, and he starts pulling out like cannonballs, and he's got a musket in the corner. And I'm trying to get to, why are you on my board? What do you do? What how can you help my museum? And he's just talking about how much he loves history. And he just at some point says, Mac, I am so jealous of you in your life. I'm like, I've been on the job for 3 weeks, dude. Come on. And there was a guy who was forced into the family business that you're going to be a banking lawyer. And he wanted so badly to be a historian, and he was. He wrote a couple of books. I encouraged him. I was like, you have the tools. You have the skills.
And he did it all kind of on the side.
Yeah. And he was one of my best board members and one of my best volunteers, but truly a man that should have been in a different career.
Yeah.
So, Keegan, I'm really interested. You know, we've been sitting here talking with Mac, and as Mac's been talking, I've been thinking, okay, we have this student in the room right now, somebody who is tasked with learning all of these different things, who is in a history class right now, you know, who is faced with this kind of endless, bottomless pit of information. And when Mac says something like, you know, the more you learn, the more you realize how little you know, what's it like as a student to kind of wrestle with that idea? Is that troubling? Is that frustrating for you?
Right now, the most troubling thing is that I have a midterm in Honors US tomorrow. But other than that, I don't have too much. But, I mean, the idea that you're never going to get to the bottom is always going to be frustrating for some people. But, I mean, that's kind of a theme throughout learning, throughout life. You're not going to have the answer that you want all the time. And I think for some kids, that's just not their cup of tea. They want to have
the one answer.
The one answer. Thing.
They want to know 2 + 2 = 4.
Exactly. That's what they want to know.
Sometimes it depends.
Yeah. Like I had said this a couple to somebody the other day, but I was reading this book called Trial by Jury by Graham Burnett. And he's a historian who goes through this trial, New York trial in 2008. And he's the foreman of a jury. And then he ends the book by saying it was interesting, or something along the lines of, it was interesting to be a part of actually answering the question answering an unanswerable question. And he goes, that's the reason why I became a historian, was because I loved being able to examine questions that can't be answered and allow them to stay unanswered. But being put on a jury, he was not allowed to do that, and that was one of the toughest things that he had to do.
Only look at what's before you.
Yeah, yeah. And you can't know the answer all the time. And I think as a historian,
it's reasonable doubt.
Yeah, exactly. As a historian, he appreciated that question, but when he got entered into the justice system, he couldn't actually answer the question. So it's actually the reverse. Mm. So I think that was it. You know, some people are just going to struggle with the fact that you're not going to be able to answer the question. Mm-hmm. And
that's the beauty to me of history, is that we may think we know something, but then you'll uncover some new evidence and realize we were totally wrong. And it's really this over here instead.
Yeah.
It requires kind of extreme, like, cognitive adaptability, right? To be at peace with this type of thing. Like, you know, you're totally fine with knowing that tomorrow you could be proven wrong on this idea or this idea.
Sure.
Right. And I guess as a historian, that's got to be exciting, knowing that will likely happen in your lifetime so many different issues,
well,
right?
Sure.
Depending on what's uncovered or discovered.
And there's different levels. I mean, between doing research and publishing an article or book, and then suddenly something comes afterwards, versus just maybe you're always saying something. Like when we were getting ready for the Astoria Bicentennial, I continually made this claim that without John Jacob Astor and the founding of Astoria in 1811, that Oregon, Idaho, and Washington will all be part of Canada today. Mm-hmm. And then we had the guy that wrote the book, PhD James Rhonda, that wrote the definitive history of John Jacob Astor and this little experiment out here. And I asked him, I said, so I've been making this claim. And he says, well, I hope you've been doing it tongue in cheek, just to make people question and ask questions and learn more. And I said, well, sort of. And he said, you don't believe that. I said, well, I think it's possible. And he said, unlikely. And I'm okay with that. Because if nothing else, the lower level of him saying, well, I hope you were just getting people starting in a conversation. And hopefully I was. And he gives me more evidence that says you shouldn't have been saying that, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, just another question that popped into my mind. How do you feel about going to your job on a daily basis? What is it like?
You know, I had a cousin that I hadn't seen since I was a kid, and we had a family reunion. We're both now in our late 30s, early 40s, and he says, so yeah, you work in a museum, huh? And I said, yeah. He said, you like that? And I had this epiphany of there's people that go to work that don't like the jobs that they do.
Yeah.
And it was honestly kind of a strange feeling that I thought, wow, do you not like your job?
Yeah.
And it was just a very strange feeling because I've been very fortunate in my life. Mm. You know, the few jobs that I've not enjoyed were when I was a kid and I just wouldn't go back to that summer job. Mm-hmm. Or the one job as an adult that I really didn't enjoy. I didn't have a family to worry about, so I was able just to walk away. Mm. And I know that you know, when you have kids, that changes. Mm. And maybe you do have to stay in that job until you find something else. Yeah. But I've been very fortunate in that regard.
Oh, cool.
Mac, I want to thank you for coming in today. Before we kind of sign off here, this show will air at the end of May. Is there any kind of history-related stuff that people in town need to know about? Anything coming up that we should be aware of?
Probably the worst timing ever, but it is history, and it still counts. June 7th is, of course, by mayoral proclamation, Goonies Day.
Okay.
It is a holiday here in town. And you know, even if you don't like the Goonies, you have to recognize the cultural and widespread significance that movie has for a lot of people. Mm. And even if it's not your thing, there are a lot of people that come to the Film Museum and to Goonies Day activities from around the world. We get visitors from all 50 states and almost 50 nations.
Wow.
And there are people that come specifically because this movie meant something to them, that it made a difference in their lives. Pulling that lens back, though, not just the Goonies. I mean, Astoria in particular in Oregon has a very rich history in film. Mm. The very first professional Hollywood movie before there was a Hollywood was filmed. That was filmed in Oregon, was filmed here in Astoria, The Fisherman's Bride in 1909, by a guy named Colonel Seelig that was the guy that invented Hollywood. So there's a rich history, and while silly things like having a pirate boat race in the Flavelle Pond may not seem quite on task, it is part of the bigger picture.
Hmm. Cool. Thanks so much.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
So this is the portion of the show where I, as the student in this interview process, get to reflect on our interviewee today. I think Mac's story helps to communicate to our audience that we should always love what we do. It's worth it to ourselves and to the people around us to pursue the things that we love to do, and it's important to appreciate what we have now, because if we can't learn how to appreciate what we have now, how could we ever learn to appreciate what we will have in the future?